what place is the place of the mind? Well, that's where we're up to in 1 Corinthians, so let's press on in 1 Corinthians. I'm not really doing an exposition of 1 Corinthians, although I'm speaking about evangelism, but I like to try and base what we're saying in some part of the scriptures and make sure that what we are saying is what the scripture is saying. So I'm not going to answer all the questions of 1 Corinthians 2. I'm not going to work our way systematically through it, but certainly we'll be looking at this section, the next section of it, and you'll notice the very first verse where we're up to shows where in fact we're up to in our thinking, because your questions are quite right. What place then does the mind have? We do, chapter 2, verse 6, 1 Corinthians, we do, however, speak a message of wisdom among the mature, but not the wisdom of this age or the rulers of this age who are coming to nothing. No, we speak of God's secret wisdom, a wisdom that has been hidden and that God destined for our glory before time began. None of the rulers of this age understood it, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. However, as it is written, no eye has seen, nor no ear has heard, no mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love him. But God has revealed it to us by his Spirit. The Spirit searches all things, even the deep things of God. For who among men knows the thoughts of a man except the man's spirit within him? In the same way, no one knows the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God. We have not received the Spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we may understand what God has freely given us. This is what we speak, not in words taught us by human wisdom, but in words taught by the Spirit, expressing spiritual truths in spiritual words. The man without the Spirit does not accept the things that come from the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually discerned. The spiritual man makes judgments about all things, but he himself is not subject to any man's judgment. For who has known the mind of the Lord that he may instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ. Not an easy passage, not a straightforward passage. In fact, there's a translation problem around about the verse 14, 15, which I'm not going to look at, but which is quite complex as to know exactly how to translate that, interpret that, and your translation may be quite seemingly radically different to what's in front of that I've just read to you. So, but I'm not looking at the whole of 1 Corinthians. I'm just trying to grasp hold of evangelism in the light of this passage. But to do it honestly and fairly to 1 Corinthians. So I will have to make some interpretive decisions there, but I'm not giving you all the background of them. When I took a mission at the University of Western Australia some years ago, they very kindly provided me with this jumper that I need every time I come to Melbourne. It has the motto of the University of Western Australia written in the bottom in English. Gone are the days of the Latin, although they've got some pig Latin up in the top. And the motto is seek wisdom. It's a good motto for a university, you would think, wouldn't it? Seek wisdom. Very clear, very straightforward. The wisdom of this world is foolish. The foolishness of God is wiser than the wisdom of this world. The Christian university student in a secular university that seeks wisdom is in some intellectual conflict. The basic way of resolving it is selling out and be a Christian with the world's wisdom. The alternative sellout is to make sure that nothing ever crosses your mind on the grounds that you're a Christian. There is the alternative. I mean, you listen to the lectures, you take in the information, you regurgitate it at the exams, you pick up the degree, but you make sure that in that whole process you haven't thought a thought. Very easy to do. In some faculties more than others. The second, of course, is the anti-intellectual, and that is a great danger. And our brother John Stott, oh, it's a pity you can't spell John with a G. You could have had Philip, Peter, John, you see, on the PPG, couldn't you? Giovanni. Should have made him Italian for a moment. He wrote a lovely little booklet for us on the Christian mind, some of the importance of the mind for the Christian, which I hope is on sale in the bookshop. Is it, Darren? And it's a lovely little book some years ago on that. And there are some other good books that come out. There's one, not in the IVP, from a man whose theological view I actually differ with when you get to the second half of the book. He's a sacramentalist in a way that I think is quite inaccurate. But called Harry Blamire's, called The Christian Mind. The first half of that book, The Christian Mind, really will blow your thinking apart. Very, very stirry, interesting, fascinating ideas, written some 20, 30 years ago now, I would think, but very good stuff. And so if you're one of those people who think, oh, I'm just a simple Bible believer, I won't have to actually do any thinking, etc., can I suggest those couple of books just for starters? Because that's not true. In understanding, be mature, be growing up, be adults. In sin, be babies. Christians tend to want to be, in sin, really growing up. And in thinking, babies. We tend to get it the exact reverse way around than what Paul is saying in 1 Corinthians 14. But it's the place of the mind at the other end that I'm actually getting at the moment. And I'm giving you the balanced one so that you won't go away saying, all right, it's just sheer intellectual. He's saying, bury your head. And make sure you don't actually ever think. I'm not saying that. And Paul's not saying it, but you can see how from verse 6, his previous attack could be interpreted that way. He says, but we do, however, speak a message of wisdom. It's not that we don't have wisdom, we do have wisdom. In fact, he's going to say, we have the wisdom. It's not anti-intellectual. It is of a different intellectual order, but it is not anti-intellectual. In fact, we have the wisdom, not the wisdom of this world, but we have wisdom. Wisdom that is only really shared amongst the mature. Who are the mature? Well, they're going to turn out to be the spiritual in verse 15. Now, are they the kind of super Christians? I don't think so. I think they're the Christians, those who have the Spirit of God. And what he's going to attack is the Corinthians, who think they're so mature, who think they're so spiritual. In chapter 3, he says, I can't talk to you as spiritual people. I can't talk to you as mature. You're babies. You're still carnal. That is, you're still not Christian in the way you're thinking. You may, and of course that's a terrible insult to a church which is raving caro, right? To actually say to them, you're not spiritual at all. Why aren't you spiritual? Because you don't think properly. Because the real sign of being spiritual is thinking properly. Very interesting idea, isn't it, that's going to come out. You forget that 1 Corinthians 12, 13, 14 is somehow attached to 1 Corinthians 2 and 3. But remember, it's the same church he's writing to. It's the same problems. The most spiritual church in the New Testament, in their own terms, turns out to be the most decadent, immoral, divided, hopeless church in the New Testament, except possibly the churches listed in the book of Revelation in that letter to the seven churches. They're really junked up, these super spiritual ones, and he's needling them on that point. He's saying we have a message that really gives us the mind of Christ, that is real wisdom. That's very important for us to grasp hold of. We, of course, are people who are caught up in the wisdom trade by going to tertiary education. And we think that the mind, the intelligence, education, is the ultimate arbiter of truth. And therefore, we want God to be responsible to and answerable to our minds. That's what we want. We will not accept the fact that our minds could be affected by sin. We will not accept the fact that our minds could, in fact, be insufficient to analyse the issue. Those two things are too insulting to us to accept. We keep on assuming that our minds are somehow intellectually neutral. I mean, Freud didn't believe it. Marx didn't believe it. And the non-Christians don't believe it. It's only the silly Christian humanists who believe it. We tend to think that our minds are unaffected by our sinfulness. The Bible clearly says they're quite heavily affected by our sinfulness. And we keep on thinking that our minds can decide any and every issue. They are omnicompetent minds. And therefore, we want to put God in the dock. And we'll sit on the bench and judge him. We forget that we are in the dock and he is on the bench. And he is in judgment of us. We forget it as Christians, but let me tell you, it's never crossed the non-Christian mind. One of the basic things we have to do with a non-Christian university person is to get God into the bench and the non-Christian back into the dock. Because he is constantly wanting you to prove God to him. As if God is somehow someone who is answerable to this puny art student. I mean, once you have conquered Arts 1, you know everything. Or at least you've got an opinion on it. Every now and then, you need to ask somebody in the midst of one of these high-flying arguments, what's the price of fish and chips in Lima? And you'll see there are all kinds of them who will actually give you a guess. Then you know it is time to order another cup of coffee or go home. We have this important God, this important idol in our lives. The mind. Very important to us because we're good in that area. That's how we got in, isn't it? If we're good in that area must be very important, mustn't it? And so, when anybody raises question about it, we feel threatened and we'll start to get a little upset. I've got a lot of questions on the subject. Very interesting, the questions you get on subjects. I was much ruder in other areas. Now, the apologist can't ignore the intellectual inquiry. But, of course, once he starts adapting the message into the intellectual inquiry of his own age, he tends to modify the message. And one of the problems of Christianity is sorting out all that the apologists of previous generations have done as they've modified it, like Augustine did for the Neoplatonic age and Aquinas did for the Aristotelian revival. So in each age, people have modified the message and we've got a junked up message because people have entered into the intellectual fray and won their own generation but changed the gospel message en route. It's one of the problems. In another form, of course, what I'm going to be saying today will take us into the whole debate that you find in books, in modern books. If you're not much of a reader at this stage, just sit and close your eyes and think about Alan Chappell for a while and what he had to say to you. But the argument that does rage in evangelical books about presuppositionalism versus evidentialism, a kind of Schaefferism schools, if you like, of that kind of presuppositional evangelism, as opposed to the Michael Green kinds of schools of the evidential kind of approach of evangelism, which you find in American literature in particular, one saying that the other's not fair and the other saying it can be done and so on. It's all got to do with the mind as to how you approach evangelism. And so what I'm saying now from this passage is very important to you. Now you can wake up those Alan Chappell thinkers. So today's task is to come to this wisdom. Here we go. Oh, I'm sorry for giving you that nightmare about thinking about Alan Chappell. Excuse me. Do you remember that we started on the Saturday night giving you the great plan of God out of the book of Revelation? That not only are we talking about the way the universe is at the moment, God on his throne, etc., but we're also talking about, on the other dimension, the way the world is going, the way it is travelling. That there is a goal to history, an end to history. That we are the people who are looking forward to the time when Christ will return, when the last trumpet, the last seal is broken rather, when that great half hour of silence comes. We're looking forward to the end of the ride of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. We're calling out how long, because the world is not just as it is, the world is actually going somewhere. That God has a plan and a purpose. He is working it out in the world. Now, 1 Corinthians 2 reflects that idea, of course. The whole Bible's consistent, one message. It reflects it there down in verses 7 and 8 of chapter 2, doesn't it? It talks about God destining this wisdom for our glory. And he does it before time began. That is, God's not a contingency plan maker. You know, he pops Adam and Eve down in the garden and then they botch it up and he says, oh, well, I better do something about that. And he comes and tries to patch it up. That's how often we preach the gospel. It's how often we think about the gospel. But before time began, Christ was already predestined to be the sacrifice for sins. So before God even started with the Adam and Eve story, he already knew that his son was going to die for the sins of the world, because that was all part of the program. That's all part of the plan. It's not that the world has kind of run amok. God fell asleep on the seventh day. He was having a little nap there, and then it all kind of, when he woke up, it had gone off in the wrong direction. And for everlastingly, he's now trying to catch up with it and turn it around the right way. That's how we speak and think. It's not like that. From the beginning, God destined for our glory something. From the beginning, the end was in view, in the mind and plan and purposes of God. And our glory was part of that. And his wisdom was the way in which that was coming about. This wisdom of God, destined for our glory, involves the crucified Lord of glory. Verse 8, you'll see it was all there. It was all his plan that the Lord of glory should be crucified. But no one understood what, notice the end of verse 9, God had prepared for those who love him. Our God's a great planner, great preparer. However, God's plans were secret. So God has this great plan for the world that you can see in the book of Revelation, you can see in all kinds of parts of the Bible, this great plan for the world which centres upon the death of Jesus, but it is kept a secret. Let's ponder about the plan for a moment, just so as to make sure we're all on board with it, because it's an opportunity for me to preach the gospel to you and I don't want to miss it. And then we'll talk about its secrecy, which is really the topic for today. See, what is God's plan? His plan and determination is that we should share in the glory of his Son. There is his plan for all eternity. That is what life is about, another way of saying it. He was to do this through his Son Jesus dying on our behalf. The eternal Son of God, the Lord of glory, was to be the heir of a great kingdom of people. A kingdom of people who would be like him. It's a fantastic notion, really, that Jesus, through whom God created the world, was the one for whom the world was created. You and I have been made for somebody else. And we have been saved for somebody else. For Jesus, that he will be the firstborn amongst many brothers. That he will have a kingdom of priests to rule with him in his glory. Yet when this Son of God became the first century Jewish man Jesus, he came to be crucified because that was God's way of bringing it about. Jesus came into the world to pay the supreme price of being the recipient of the wrath of God for the world, to bear the rebellion of mankind and to pay the penalty for rebellious people, to die in order to set us free, to wash us clean, to liberate slaves, to make them kings, to wash sinners, to make them priests. That is what he comes to do. So that Jesus crucified rises up, the beginning of the new humanity, and sends out his messengers to call people into that humanity, to call people into sharing the blessings that he has won for them. Here is the great plan of God. The crucifixion of the Lord of glory. The bringing many sons to that glory. That's the plan of God, isn't it? And one sense you're saying to yourself, yeah, well, that's all right. Philip, we, you know, we're evangelicals. We know that, right? You're telling us the gospel again. Doesn't hurt you. Doesn't hurt me to tell it again. Doesn't hurt me to hear it again, because it's a very weird idea. Very unnatural. Very strange. I need to be constantly reminded of it. It's not human wisdom. It's God's wisdom. It also might save you next time round. Because one of the troubles is you can hear it over and over again and not actually grasp it. What I'm saying actually has big implications. Listen to them for a few moments now. Because God's plan only works if God keeps it secret. God's plan only works if God keeps it secret. That's not fair, you see. We don't like people keeping secrets, especially people keeping secrets from us. There's always something nasty about people keeping secrets from us, isn't it? But that's what it says, you see, verse 8. They wouldn't have crucified him if they knew what they were doing. And so God didn't let them know what they were doing. See that? The plan wouldn't work unless it was a secret. Look back to chapter 1, verse 21. Since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know God, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. That's a funny verse, isn't it? Man thinks he will get to know God by wisdom. But God's wisdom is that man won't get to know God by his wisdom. God has actually put a blockage in man's wisdom that will not allow man in his wisdom to get to know God. Why? Well, because God's plan was not about man's wisdom. It was not about man in an intellectual inquiry finding the Almighty. God's plan was about the Lord of glory being crucified by men. He didn't understand what God's plan was about, so God keeps it a secret. Very interesting, isn't it? Destined for glory for time again. Kept secret. Now, how has he kept it a secret? How? Well, you see, there is a limit to human understanding. We must grasp hold of it. The limit to human understanding. Not just the limit of sinfulness, which is also here, but the absolute limits to human understanding. You see, if God is a thought, then rationalism is the way to find God. If God is an object, then empiricism might do. But if God is a person, then you'll only know him if he wants you to. Quite different, isn't it? Well, what I'm saying is true of humans too. Let me show you, for example. I have underneath my jumper a shirt. I don't think you can see my shirt under my jumper. Hope not, it'll ruin my illustration if you can. Think about my shirt. It's better than thinking about my body. Think about my shirt. What colour is it? What texture? What kind of shirt? What is this shirt that Philip's got? Just think it up. You know, see, if my shirt is only a thought, like mathematics, like the rules of chess, backgammon, then you could think it up. You got a chance anyway, haven't you? Because rationalism is very good at that level. But my shirt is an object. And you can sit there and think till the cows come home. That's just after Paul White's milk. You can think all you like. You will not be able to think what my shirt is, will you? You won't even be able to get the colour right. I mean, you might say it's one without a neck, otherwise it would be popping out the top. But then again, I could have hidden it from you, couldn't I? I could have it purposely turned down so as not to give you the clues. Rationalism has a particular limitation, hasn't it? It's not real good at dealing with objects. Very good at dealing with ideas. But empiricism is good at looking at objects. So you can find out an object. You see, three or four beautiful girls can race up on the stage and rip the shirt off him. Happens to me all the time, everywhere I go. Ripping the jumper off. And then you would be able to see. They could actually investigate to find out. And then you could say, oh, well, his shirt is. Let me show you. Now my shirt. There you are. All right. You didn't think that one up, did you? Don't think that out, you see. You only learned that. Whatever you did think, red, green, yellow, polka dot, you didn't think. Empiricism, you found out, you observed, because it's an object, it's not a thought, it's an object. Trouble with that just by the by, is it's such a powerful illustration, you'll have forgotten what it illustrates, won't you? Right? 10 years' time, you'll remember the time that he took his shirt off and showed, but you'll have forgotten what on earth it is. But try and grasp hold of the point I'm making, because it's a very big, important one. All right. But God is not an object. So that's not going to help you. God is a person. Three persons, one God. Now, being personal God, you've got real problems. What is the most wonderful fishing moment that my brother has ever had? My elder brother, not my younger brother. Peter is my younger brother. I've got two brothers. They're both older than me. Right? One's older than the other, so Peter's my younger brother. Now, my older brother, what is the most wonderful moment of fishing he has ever had? In our family, catching one's nothing. We sit out there for days without catching them. I know. You see, by rationalism, you're not going to work it out, isn't it? You can't just sit here and work that one out, can you? And empiricism's not going to work it out either, because you could have run a video on my brother all his life, could have seen every fish he caught, but you still couldn't know, could you? Because the most wonderful one is the one that he told me about the other day. I could never have found out by thinking it or by observing it. I could only know it because it was his most wonderful moment, and he had to tell me. Here is always the problem in the humanities, that when you get the human and you examine the human is examining you. You're not dealing with an object, you're dealing with a person who's got as much thoughts going on in his brain as you've got going on in yours. In fact, in some disciplines I've noticed, the objects have much more, so it's very hard to work out who's the subject and object, isn't it? Yeah, you're right. Psychiatry was what I was thinking. There you go. Here is the problem. Now, what are we dealing with God? An idea? Because rationalism would be marvellous, but he's not an idea. But of course, some people have reduced God to the idea. They're rationalists. They think that by sitting down and thinking up wonderful traditional proofs of the existence of God, they'll come to God. Especially that ontological proofs. Marvellous piece of rationalism. It's got nothing to do with a personal God, necessarily. Very clever argument. Very clever idea. But we're dealing with a person. And there are some who are empiricists and who think that if they could just find out all the evidences, they would. But that's not always the case, too, because we're still dealing with a person. And you'll only know this person when this person reveals themselves to you. When they sit out and say, that is what happened, and this was the meaning of it, and that's why I did what I did, and this is what it means to me. Then I will know that person. See, you don't know my older brother, do you? You know my younger brother. How do you know my younger brother? The first day when you got here, you didn't know him. He was just sitting in the crowd. You didn't know him. But when he started speaking, he started revealing himself. He showed his inadequacies about being threatened about his little brother. He revealed his incapacity to read close up and takes his glasses down and looks. You know, all kinds of things about him. The grey hair, which is testimony to his five children, and a whole range of things. I wouldn't have given him. He didn't have grey hair when he left me. I can't look at Christine at the moment. I'm just coping down here. Now, you find out all kinds of things. You actually find out something about both of us, don't you? You find out that there is a family that obviously had humour as part of it, and knocking, that Australian kind of delight in humour, of teasing and tantalising and rubbing and ribbing each other all the time, isn't it? That's the kind of people they are. How did you find that out? It wasn't by rationalism. Didn't know that before you came, did you? It wasn't by investigation. It was because they revealed themselves to you. We are revealing ourselves to you. It's the only way you can get to know a person. Now, of course, that's a terrible insult to the human mind. Because it says, you can't find out. I've got a secret. And God says that to mankind. you can't find me. Look, look, yes, he challenges, he inquires, he challenges, he tells people, look for me, but I will only be found when I want to be found. In the way I want to be found, as I reveal myself. Now you see how this ties in, by the way, to what Peter's saying about the whole authority of the Bible and Revelation? The gospel, evangelism, and the doctrine of the authority of the scriptures go hand in hand. You can't have one without the other. Because the implications are massive, you see. Paul is saying, in verses 10 following, who knows a man but the spirit of that man? Anyone who knows. And therefore it's only the spirit of that man who can tell you that man is like. Likewise with God. Who knows God but the spirit of God? And so how do we know what God is like? Because the Spirit has revealed what God is like. He's in a perfect position to know what God is like, for he is God. He is part and parcel of what we call God. And if he speaks, inspires his prophets, teaches the apostles what it's about, reveals himself through the scriptures, if he speaks, then that message, because it has come from the Spirit of God, is the message of what God is like. It's not then a matter of me liking it, it's a matter of me lumping it. Here it is. This is God telling us about God. You know anyone who knows him better? No, of course not. This is the message. Not to be argued with, but received. Not to be quarrelled over, but obeyed. Because it is God. And so how is God revealed? By the Spirit. So that Paul knows God, for the Spirit knows God. The Spirit who opens our minds, which overcomes the sin problem and the warp that is in our mind, I may say, it's called regeneration, who opens our mind to receive that message from God. And so that section about the spiritual people, that section about the Spirit of God revealing things to people who otherwise couldn't understand them in verses 13 and 14. The man without the Spirit doesn't accept the things that come from the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him. He cannot understand them because it's a matter of spiritual discernment. That is, God the Spirit, who has the message, brings it to us and opens up our minds that we will receive that message. And the end result of it is, says Paul, those of us who are spiritual mature, we have the mind of Christ. And so we can make judgments about all things. That doesn't mean you'll improve your calculus if you become a Christian. I don't expect all Christians to win university medals because, you see, those things are given out by people who don't believe in Christian wisdom, who are working in the world's wisdom. And furthermore, the wisdom of God doesn't cover all the details of life. And many of the non-Christians find out the details of life quite correctly. You don't have to say, well, the DNA molecule, now that was worked out by man, he doesn't believe in God, so it must be wrong. Won't learn about that except to pass my exam. I mean, that's ridiculous. That man is part of the creation of God, given a mind to work things out. But once you've worked it out, the meaning and significance of it won't be given to a man who doesn't know the meaning and significance of life. I haven't got all the details of life. Many of our non-Christians know much more of the details of life and the universe and existence than I know, or that all of us collectively here would know. But no non-Christian has any understanding of the meaning and purpose of what life is about. Because they haven't got the secret, the fundamental secret of God, that the Lamb that is slain is on the throne. That's the key. And all of knowledge needs to be fitted in under that great framework that is found in Revelation 4 and 5, that great framework of the plan of God from before the foundation of the world, that the Lord of glory should be crucified in order to bring many sons to glory in the end. There's the great scheme. Now you can fit in your DNA molecule. Now you can fit in your calculus. Now you can fit in all kinds of other things if you like, because we have the mind of Christ as to what it's about. And we haven't got it through our cleverness, but because it's been revealed to us. It's been shown to us. The Spirit of God has opened our minds and hearts to understand it. Not the clever people, but the lowly and unimportant, the despised, the nothings. Now, the implications of this passage are massive. It's not the most popular passage, chapter 2 of 1 Corinthians, is it? You haven't heard many sermons on it, do you? It's one of those bits we flip past quickly. But it's great stuff. Go back and think through it carefully. Very important section, this one. The implications I want to bring under three headings. Number one is the mind.
because there are big implications to the mind, aren't there? It's not saying that the mind and thought and intellectual endeavour is useless, stupid, unwanted. No, it's not saying that at all. The mind is all very important. It's just setting us where the limits of the mind are. It's not saying the mind is unimportant. And in fact, once the gospel comes, it breaks open the limits of the mind and it calls upon us to be greater thinkers yet, deeper and more profound in our thought. The mind must be used Christianly, with the Christian framework that involves this revelation. Now that should give us an aggressive attack on this world's epistemology, which fails to take into account the whole meaning of the universe. We know they don't know. I know two things now. I know the meaning of the universe, and I also know that they don't know the meaning of the universe. So I know that any meaning of the universe they care to give me is going to be wrong. So it's good to attack, because it's bound to be wrong, and I'll always be able to show it's wrong. It's fun, you see. It gives you tremendous power to get down the front foot and hit them for six. Right? Christians have got to stop seeing apologetics as going back. They've got to see apologetics as going forward down the pitch to play the strikes. The best defence is offence. When you grasp that we have the mind of Christ, when you really believe that, and no longer are you fearful of all the alternative philosophies and ideas that may be coming forward. They are wrong. With that in mind, I can move on to the offensive, can't I? I've only got to look for where it's going to be wrong, where it's going to fall apart. It always does. The sinfulness of mankind is one of them. Yeah, this terrible optimistic humanism that gets vomited out of the United Nations about how things are going to get better and better and better, and they're not. Blind Freddy can see they're not. Getting worse and worse and worse. The absolute meaningless and stupid, this stupidity of life that comes out of a beyond freedom and responsibility of the Skinnerian school. It's all meaningless, it's all stupid ultimately, and that's why he writes you such meaningful books to persuade you to think it through. Basically stupid, isn't it? Or the sociologists who want to say, well, of course you believe what you believe because you've come from that kind of background. Now, why do sociologists believe that? Because they've come from that kind of background. That wasn't you, Ruth, particular. I'm sorry, it was that time. I should have gone more that way, shouldn't I? Man, that's... You know, Berger calls that the relativizing of the relativizers. Good line, that one. Because the non-Christian philosophies will always, in fact, be wrong. If Christ is right. Now, don't get me wrong at this point. And therefore, he's saying that people's understanding of aspirin is inaccurate. I'm saying, no. I'm talking about the big philosophies of life, what it's all about, where it's all going, what is the meaning of the events, and so on. A non-Christian has nothing to say that will be right if Christianity is right. So it has big effects on your mind. Second thing. And this seems almost contradictory, and some of you emotionally will feel it dreadfully. This prevents arrogance. This teaching, you think, well, I've never heard anything quite as arrogant as Philip Jensen in my life. How can it now prevent arrogance? It prevents arrogance. Because in our meritocracy, the idea that those who succeed should be given more opportunities and succeed given more opportunities, we have developed a meritocracy in being clever, as if being clever was something other than the accident of your birth and background. We actually think we deserve more things because we have got better examinership. Some of us know some more things as well. And therefore, one of our rankings of people have got to do with clever people as opposed to not so, as opposed to not so, as opposed to thick. Right? And we have great fear and reverence and respect and awe of clever people. That's going to have implications on our evangelism, isn't it, in a moment, which is the third of my headings, but let's keep on this arrogance one. That kind of cleverness worship divides the Christian congregation, doesn't it? He's a very mature Christian, by which we mean he can find a Bible verse at the flip of a pen. The flip of a pen, you know, he just opens straight up, bang, into Obadiah. First hit, very mature as a Christian. We say they're mature as a Christian when they know a lot. Rubbish. A person is mature as a Christian when they are godly in their lifestyle. I've met very knowledgeable, ungodly people. You have lots up here. That's not what it's about. And also because of the cleverness, we follow the great pundits. Or even in evangelical circles, we can play them off. You see, this writer against that writer, this preacher against that preacher. Divide ourselves into schools, it's very easy, you see. I follow Paul, I follow Apollos, I follow... See how it's done? Because we think cleverness is what matters. Real whiz-bang theological perception. We actually start to think that God selects people to heaven on the basis of their intelligence. Well, you know that can't be right, don't you? But you see, if the way to God is by being rich, well, then the rich would live and the poor would die. If the way to God is by human inquiry, then the clever would live and the stupid would die. Isn't that right? The way to God is not that. The way to God is by Jesus dying on your behalf. God came to you. You didn't find God, he found you. You didn't know about God, he told you. That being the case, there's no point priding yourself on the fact that you know God. Not greatly to your credit that you know the secret. You only know the secret because he chose to tell you the secret. So you can't go around saying, aren't I clever, aren't I wonderful, I found the secret. Liberal theology is full of puffed up arrogance. Always parading their degrees, their titles. The degrees of divinity, of course, are the pathway to hell. Because they puff a man up. Knowledge puffs up, love builds up. That kind of knowledge, not the way, you see. I won't present on it. The arrogance is actually undermined by the recognition that I didn't know God, I didn't discover God, I didn't find God. He found me and told me. When I was dumb and thick and stupid, I didn't understand, I couldn't understand, I was limited in my sinfulness, warped. It cuts the underneath of arrogance and therefore puts us all on the same plane. And the beauty of it. Got a lovely friend in our church who's below average in intelligence, can't get a job. Been out of work for years. And when he talks about the gospel, he's got it absolutely right. He tells you about the Lord Jesus dying for him and things like that, and it's crystal clear. And you hear the Bishop of West Bulamacanca getting up with all his doctorates and the rest of it and babbling on, you know, the foggiest clue. Big long words, but not the slightest meaning of what the gospel's about. It's got nothing to do with brains. Isn't that a relief? Nothing to do with brains. You see what an important thing is said here? Now that's going to have a big impact on our evangelism, the third and last one to which I'm coming. I'm sorry I'm running a bit late, Andrew. I started a bit late though, brother. Look at the implications for evangelism. It means that evangelism is a spiritual activity and not an intellectual activity. You want to write that one down? Because that's the one that university evangelists are the lousiest at. It's a spiritual activity, not an intellectual activity. Now, have I just said, therefore, you don't use your mind at all? No, I haven't said that. If you've heard me saying that, you've misheard me. Go back and buy the tape. Won't do you any harm anyway. Read it, listen to it too. And I'm saying... Yeah, well, you know, you don't read books anymore, you just photostat them, right? You don't listen to talks, you just buy the tape. Now, what you've got to do is see it as a spiritual activity, not an intellectual activity. Very important to grasp that principle. You cannot argue people into the kingdom of God. You cannot reason them into it, argue them into it. When I first discovered apologetics about 20 years ago now, filled with all the arguments, filled with all the books, I ran out into meetings and I argued. I demonstrated, I proved, I beat them down. One after another, and none of them converted. Some of them went home with their tails between their legs. They weren't converted. Never, you can't argue anybody into the kingdom of heaven because it's a spiritual thing. That's not what it's about. It's not about arguments. Well, what's it about? It's about praying, because it's a spiritual activity. It's only as the God, the Spirit, opens their hearts and minds to understand the gospel that they will grasp it. Praying, and I want to say preaching because it's got the PR in it, but I don't mean standing on the pulpit, I mean declaring. It's telling. It's telling the old story that Jesus died for your sins and explaining what that means. That's all it is. It's telling them about the Lord of glory who was crucified. It's preaching Christ and him crucified, declaring Christ and him crucified. Now, when you grasp that, friends, it liberates you. Because one of the horrendous effects of living in a meritocracy is everybody feels inferior, except me. Because it doesn't matter how smart you are, you've always met one bloke who's smarter. No matter how fast you run, you've always met somebody who can run faster. No matter how big you are, you always meet someone who's bigger. And you always tend to measure yourself against the person who's bigger, smarter, faster, right? You say, well, I'm not the best. By which means I'm third best in the universe. But I'm not the best. And one of the crucial things, if you are, then of course someone comes along who's younger. That's the cruelest cut of all. You never can be the best, can you? And so when you think that the whole activity is an intellectual activity and you know that you're not the best, you are constantly fearful, aren't you? One of the residing fears of university evangelism is that if I start entering into this discussion, they'll have clever arguments that I can't answer. Clever questions they ask me that I don't know. And so I'll wait till I know everything and then I'll start evangelising. That is in heaven. See, once you grasp hold of the fact that it's praying and telling a story, then the common man can do it, can't it? It liberates. Any of us can have a bash at that. All I've got to do is tell him about it. Well, I can explain that. And I can pray with difficulty. I can pray. That's all I've got to do. That's what you've got to do, yes. Francis Schaeffer, Michael Green, Paul Little, they were an enormous help to me in filling me with good arguments to be used and good apologetics, and I still encourage you to read them, but they are terrible tyrants. Because you have this feeling that unless you've mastered all those arguments, unless you've got all the facts on your fingertips and can rattle them out immediately, then you could never evangelise anybody. So the best way of evangelising is to fly Michael Green over here to do it for you. You can't get the other two, they're in heaven already. But you can still get Michael, I understand, unless there's a message that I haven't heard yet. Right. And so you get the great Houdini in, who's got all the arguments at his fingertips, and then you go. But that's all you've got to do is pray and preach. Pray and tell people about it. And God's Spirit is the powerful agent that gives the mind of Christ to them. It liberates the common man. And of course, in chapter 2, verses 1 and chapter 4 and verse 4, you'll see it affects your whole method of preaching. No longer do you have to use eloquence, superior wisdom. No longer do you have to use persuasive words. You just have to trust God. So when you come, some of you out even this week sharing the gospel in the streets around about, scared out of your wits. I am. But then I don't have many wits to be scared out of. Scared out of your wits, right? Trust God. Because it is his work you are doing. Pray for the people. The Lord will lead you to the people he wants you to speak to, that he is preparing. Pray that he would prepare their hearts for the message, and try and get into the relationship where you can just explain to them what the gospel is. And the funny thing is, after it's over, you'll say, that wasn't so bad. That was cool. That was great fun. We should do that more often. And the person you're with will say, yes, what about tomorrow? And you'll say, oh, no.